Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to MiX 2011. My name is Jason Weber, and I'm the performance lead for Internet Explorer. And for the past couple of years, I've been focused on making the browser fast through hardware-accelerated graphics, the new JavaScript compiler, our brand new layout engine, and I've learned a lot about performance along the way, both performance from a browser runtime perspective and performance from a web application perspective. I've also personally built a lot of the demos that you may have seen on the IE test drive, such as the fishbowl demos, speed reading, psychedelic browsing, a lot of these kind of fun perf demos. And I've been doing that as a way to really build content that pushes the web platform harder and allows us to really tune our runtime against these next generation of scenarios. Today, we're going to talk about performance. And we're going to specifically talk about 50 performance tips and tricks to make your HTML5 websites and HTML5 applications faster, both loading of pages as well as the runtime performance of your applications. And we're going to do that by taking an inside look at the browser and really understanding what does it mean to be fast from a browser runtime perspective. I'm going to talk about six principles today that you can take away from MiX that you can apply to your web applications on a daily basis as you're writing code. And those principles will help you build faster web applications. And then we'll talk about 50 specific tips and tricks that you can apply today. And these tips and tricks apply not just to Internet Explorer, but they apply to all browsers almost equally. Now, 50 is a lot of content to get through in the next 57 minutes. And so I would encourage you to not worry about taking notes. All the slides are available online. This video is recorded and will be available online. So really just kind of go with the flow of the session. Don't worry about the specific lines of code. Look at the patterns and the principles. We're going to cover a lot of technical content here. There's going to be a lot of code snippets on the screen, a lot of HTTP headers. If you're not a web developer, this may not be the best session for you because we're going to go through this content very quickly. So let's go ahead and start with a test. How much do you know about web performance? I'm guessing there's a lot of people in the room that know quite a bit. And that's why you're here. Others that may not know it much. So we'll start with a test. I took five newspapers that have both print media as well as online media websites, and I profiled them last weekend in Internet Explorer 9. So all of this content is fresh. It's less than 72 hours old. Sites like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times. Now, from a user experience perspective, these sites are very similar. They're all showing the headline news. They're all downloading asynchronously stock quotes in the background. They're all bringing down advertisements. They all have analytics and instrumentation trying to measure what you're doing on the site. They all have often interactive, rich flash content. From user experience, they're very similar. But architecturally, websites are very different. And that architecture is what influences performance. So I took the five news sites, and I've anonymized them here, and I call them newspaper 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. But let's look at a little bit of the architecture of the sites. Let's start with the total number of kilobytes that are downloaded for PLT2, the second time that you've browsed to the site. So this means a fully warm cache. And you can see that there's quite a divergence here between 400K for newspaper number 4 all the way up to 2.2 megabytes for newspaper number 3. So quite a significant difference. If we look at the number of elements across the page, it ranges from about 800 to well over 2,000 elements in the page. If we look at the number of CSS rules in the cascade, you can see that there's also quite a significant variance there between about 570 all the way up to close to 3,200 CSS rules, a factor of 6. If you look at the number of images, again, it ranges from about 30 all the way up to well over 100 images that these sites might download. The number of script blocks ranges, the total lines of JavaScript, again, from about 10,000 to close to 30,000 lines of JavaScript. And then the script frameworks that these sites may use. You can see that they're using some of the most popular frameworks in the world, frameworks like jQuery or the Yahoo UI library or Prototype. Okay, so here's the test part of the day. So which of the newspaper sites loads the fastest? Okay, I'm hearing a couple of different answers. I'll let you guys kind of all mentally think of it. And the correct answer is newspaper site number 2. Now, this often surprises people. They usually look and say, well, the one with the least amount of JavaScript loads the fastest, or the least amount of data downloaded off the web loads the fastest. In reality, news site number 2 is not the best or worst at any of these characteristics. It's just consistently good at these dimensions and happens to load the fastest. Okay, now which of these news sites, newspapers, loads the slowest? Well, the most common answer is news site number 4, because it has 27,000 lines of JavaScript, and people often think, well, there's so much code there, it has to be the slowest. But it's actually newspaper site number 5. And again, if you look at this dimension by dimension, it's actually not the worst at any of these dimensions. It doesn't have the most data download, it doesn't have the most JavaScript, but it's consistently on the high end of each of these dimensions. And the runtime patterns, especially the runtime patterns we're going to talk about today, are not necessarily performant. So where does all that time go, right, from when these pages are loaded, and why do these runtime patterns matter so much? I thought we should spend a few minutes and talk about kind of how browsers work conceptually. All browsers, whether it's, you know, Internet Explorer or Google Chrome or Mozilla Firefox, are composed of a set of subsystems that really conceptually do the same thing. In the case of Internet Explorer, we're composed of 11 subsystems. And that starts with the networking subsystem. When you type in a URL or click on a link, the first thing we need to do is go in and initiate that network request to download the document. And that networking subsystem really sits there waiting until that document comes back down and then returns it to the browser. The second subsystem that kicks in is an HTML subsystem that is responsible for parsing that HTML and building internal data structures that represent the DOM of that subsystem. And then it might find additional resources that need to be downloaded, so it'll fire back to the networking subsystem and those will download. The third subsystem that often comes into play is the CSS subsystem, which takes all your style information and it parses it to internal data structures that represent your styles. The fourth is a collection subsystem, which you can really think of as a bunch of metadata about the site, a property bag of general information that might be referenced. Of course, there's the JavaScript subsystem, which is responsible for taking your JavaScript, parsing it out, creating abstract syntax trees, interpreting your JavaScript. In the case of Internet Explorer 9, we compile your JavaScript down to native machine code and, of course, executing it. So there's a lot that happens in that JavaScript subsystem. Of the subsystems in the browser, this is the one that people are most familiar with, often because of benchmarks. They you know, will often become fixated on benchmarks and try to measure browser performance through that JavaScript subsystem. JavaScript's programming the DOM, and so there's time spent in the DOM traversing trees, manipulating trees, adding and removing elements. There's often time spent between the JavaScript engine and the DOM in a tier called marshalling. In previous versions of Internet Explorer 9, the JavaScript engine was not natively integrated into the browser. It was actually an external component, and it communicated via COM. This is true in older versions of Firefox as well. And so there could be time spent between this communication tier. Kind of the next subsystem is called a formatting subsystem. So our HTML subsystem has constructed this HTML document, internal data structures. Our CSS subsystem is constructed all of our CSS data structures. And formatting subsystems takes these two data structures and maps them together and formats your page that's about to appear on the screen. Now, after it's been formatted, we have to build blocks. CSS is a block-based layout model. So there's a subsystem or a step that composes your page into a bunch of discrete blocks. And then layout comes along and it lays out those blocks. It figures out the locations and the flows and the Z orders of all of your content, and then finally your content is rendered to the screen. Each of these 11 subsystems impact performance, and you have to think about all 11 of these as you're building your web application. So if we go back to those 5 newspaper sites that we looked at earlier, here's the page load times of those in terms of CPU time in the browser, color-coded by where that time is spent. So if we look at newspaper site number 1, you'll see that, you know, in red, there was a lot of time spent in the JavaScript subsystem, but the majority of time was spent in rendering of the page itself. If we go to newspaper site number 2, you can see it loaded the fastest, at a little over 500 milliseconds. And the time was pretty well equally distributed across the different subsystems. If we jump over to newspaper site number 5, which, if you recall, loaded the slowest at about 2 seconds, 2 1/4 seconds, you'll see there's a lot of time spent in all of these tiers, a lot of time in script, a lot of time in that layout pipeline and the formatting pipeline, and then finally the rendering pipeline. If we take these 5 newspaper sites and we average them together, we get a pie chart that looks like this. This kind of gives us a more global view of where the time goes when you're loading a site like a newspaper site. And you can see it's pretty well distributed. Again, a lot of time spent in JavaScript, but this layout pipeline actually consumes the majority of the time, as does the rendering piece, which is in purple. This should give you some perspective on why we're focused so much on hardware-accelerated graphics and hardware-accelerating the entire web platform. The more we can leverage the GPU, the more we can offload computation to the GPU, the smaller we can make this purple piece. Now, the question I often get is, these are loading newspaper sites. What about Ajax sites, right? I'm a Web 2.0 developer. I want to build Facebook, and I want to build Twitter, and people navigate to my site once, but then they never leave. Well, we took the top 25 interactive Ajax scenarios, sites like Facebook and Hotmail, the Office Web Companions, Gmail, and we instrumented and measured scenarios across those sets of applications. And you'll see that when we kind of do a similar analysis and we aggregate those together, this will show you where the time is spent in those Ajax scenarios. Now, this looks very different. If we go back to loading the newspaper sites and we come forward to these Ajax scenarios, you'll see a different set of patterns. And one of the patterns you'll see is that in Ajax applications, less time is actually spent in JavaScript and more time is spent in rendering. And this is often a surprise to people. They think to themselves, but the J in Ajax stands for JavaScript. And, you know, Ajax is all about JavaScript performance. But if you think about your web applications, your Ajax scenarios, what often occurs is you have a small amount of JavaScript that executes and will manipulate a couple of DOM properties to animate something around the screen or to change a value. And after you've manipulated those DOM properties, it has to go through this entire browser pipeline of kind of the formatting and the layout and the block building and display to get those results to the screen. And so you'll see that for those Ajax scenarios, that interactivity and that layout pipeline is key. Okay, so now to the good part of the presentation, the 50 best practices. And I have to admit, I actually have 57. I had a hard time trimming it down to 50. And that means we're going to have less than 1 minute on each of these best practices. So again, all of this content is online. Don't worry about taking notes. Just follow along during the presentation. Key off a couple of key best practices, and then you can come back to them later. The first principle we're going to talk about and the best practices associated with that are to quickly respond to network requests. The network is a key part of performance, especially the initial network requests that are serviced from the browser. And the first thing to think about is to avoid redirection. Of the newspaper sites that I talked about, 3 of the 5 actually redirect their initial request to the news site itself. Now, what that means is you might actually make the request to news.com, but in the response, you're redirected to another homepage, like homepage.news.com. So your browser makes a request, and then it's waiting for that request to come back, and then it knows now where it needs to go, so then it makes another request to that next location. So you've done 2 round trips while the browser is sitting idle waiting for data to get back for it to start processing. So be very careful about redirection, especially using 303s. Browsers try to be intelligent and cache that data, but depending on your site architecture, it may not be possible. In that same context, avoid metadata refreshes, or using the meta tag to refresh your page. You would be surprised at how pervasive this is across the web. And the idea is you might have a simple little page that has in the header, a redirect to a different site. In this case, redirects to news2.com. Again, this requires 2 full round trips to the server from the client before we can even start processing the original page. And the one that just pains me the most are these timed redirects, which I'm sure you've seen all over the web, where you browse to a site and it says, you'll be redirected in 10 seconds. And then it counts down, 9, 8. The whole time you're sitting there waiting, thinking, what are you doing? Why are you waiting 10 seconds to redirect me when it could be instantaneous? Over 1% of the pages on the web are actually meta redirects. Okay, the third best practice, minimize the server time required for your requests. So let's assume that our initial request is going right to the source and we're going to be able to get content back. So we make our request from the browser. The web server receives that request. Now, the web server may return static content to us, which it could just pull off a cache or off disk and send it right back. So there's little time spent on the web server. But as you start to look at the HTML5 interactive applications of today, an unfortunate pattern we're seeing is that more and more time is being spent in the server side constructing the page that's going to be returned to the client. A common pattern is that web servers may actually have multiple servers they're talking to. They might go and grab your user credentials out of one database. They might go and talk to another user database for your data. They might go and grab some business information or stock quotes or out of another database. That initial, especially for the initial page, the amount of time spent constructing that page can significantly impact performance. One of the metrics that I like to encourage is that to measure your actual server-side time for your initial request and to keep it under 2 milliseconds. Use content distribution networks or CDNs. If you think of the scenario where you might have a user in Atlanta, that user might be talking to a server in Seattle. And that means that the data has to go from Atlanta to Seattle, but it's not going to fly the same way that a plane flies. It's going to travel the path of the internets. And that could mean going through California, it could mean going through different directions. Whereas, CDNs allow you to replicate your data around the world. And people are often intimidated when I talk about CDNs. They think about large, complex infrastructures, high costs. But the reality is, for about $30-$40 a month, you can very quickly create a CDN leveraging Windows Azure or several of the web providers that are out there today. This allows you to route that request directly to a local data source, serve it directly back to Atlanta from, say, Virginia or Austin, cutting out 75, 80, 90% of that actual physical traffic and the laws of physics. Maximize the concurrent connections to your server. A browser today, most browsers today, will establish about 6 connections to a particular domain. And those 6 connections are concurrent, and if you have to download, 60 resources, that means you'll only be able to, you'll have to tier them up. Whereas if you distribute your resources across multiple domains and multiple domain names, the browser can establish 6 concurrent connections to each of those domains and download your resources in parallel. So if you think about that scenario where you might have 60 resources on your page, you should be able to download the majority of those in parallel across different domains. This really complements the CDN model well, especially for your static resources. Reuse connections, especially when you're working with SSL-based content. After the browser has established a connection to the server and has fully downloaded the content from the server, we might receive a connection close, which means we have to close that connection and then reestablish a new connection before we can download the next resource on your page. This is a very common problem, especially for individuals who might have picked up kind of a standard distribution of different servers that are out there, such as Apache. This is actually a fun one. This was from an Apache configuration script that was available on the web just up until a year or two ago, where if the browser was MSIE, it would not keep alive that session to work around a bug in IE 3 through 5. So if you're worried about Internet Explorer 3 through 5, I encourage you to keep this in there. If you're worried about performance, I would encourage you to really look carefully at your configurations and make sure you're keeping your connections alive. Okay, principle number 2. So after we have a model where we're quickly responding to web requests, we really need to minimize the number of bytes that are downloaded from the web. A great way to do that is just to compress all your traffic. When the browser makes the request, it'll say that it supports the gzip, for example, encoding. And in your response, you can just say that your content is gzip encoded, and then that means that there'll be less bytes traveling over the internet. Now, most servers today support gzip encoding by default. It's a configuration flag in Apache and IIS, so you just go ahead and can set that and can receive encoding for free. Make sure that you provide cacheable content. This is the best way to decrease the number of bytes downloaded. Don't download them at all. And the way that you do this is that in your response, you just specify when that content expires. In this case, it expires on March 19th. And so any requests before March 19th can just be served directly from the cache rather than requested from the server again. So browser caches are getting quite efficient. They're getting quite large. Browsers are doing a really good job today of making sure that we keep the most important resources for that user around. And so by marking your content as cacheable, especially if that user is a frequent visitor of your site, it's very likely to be there. Now, when I talk with customers, one of the reasons they're hesitant to mark their content as cacheable is because they're worried about a user having an old version of a resource in their page, an old image or an old icon. And so especially for some newer web developers, they're very nervous about this. A great way to do that is to use conditional requests. And you can say, well, you know, still send the request, but only re-download if that file has actually been modified. And so there's still a request in there, but there's actually not any bytes being transferred over the wire. You can also cache data requests in the browser cache itself. This is a great example of, on the left, we have kind of an example of jQuery data request for a JSON object. By default, the best practice I recommend is to cache all of your requests in the browser cache. The browser will attempt to do this by default. And in most cases, it will do a pretty good job. But if you don't attempt to override that, the browser can keep that data around. And then in the cases where you don't want it cached, just have a method to override that cache default property. So kind of in that same regard, I'd recommend standardizing on file capitalization conventions. This is often a surprise to web developers, but the casing of your files actually matters. URIs are case sensitive. And so if you look at this example here, we have three different ways that we've cased the same image. The one that I often call is, you know, like to call out as careless developer case. And we've all seen this when we look at a directory of images on a website and seen kind of confusing icon names. The browser views these as distinct individual icons, and we have to make a new request for each of these. The server may actually serve up the same image every time. It may resolve these to the same, but we have to treat them as three different ones. We have to treat three copies of it in the cache itself. And so you could inadvertently be downloading more resources than you need. Okay, principle number three. And this is probably one of the most important principles in terms of page load experience and page load performance. The first best practice within this principle is to make sure that your content loads in the latest browser mode. For compatibility reasons, Internet Explorer 9 has four modes. The Quarks mode for legacy IE, which includes all the quirks and the legacy box model associated with IE. An IE standards mode, which emulates all the IE 7 experience. The IE 8 standards mode, which again emulates all the IE behaviors. And then finally, IE 9 standards mode, which is the default HTML5 mode within IE. This default mode the default mode is always the fastest, this latest standards mode. And you can enter this mode just by using the HTML5 document type in your page. By default, we're going to try to put you in this latest mode unless, for example, you specify a doc type or a meta tag or an HTTP header that pulls you back into one of the legacy modes. Now, the challenge with the legacy modes is that they have all the kind of the slowness of the legacy versions of Internet Explorer. For example, the IE8 standards mode actually contains the IE8 rendering engine and layout engine end-to-end. So make sure you're specifying the latest mode and doc type. Now, there are a few cases where you have content that may have been designed for an older version of IE, for example, IE6 or IE8. And for compatibility reasons, you want to force that content to render in this legacy pipeline inside Internet Explorer. There's two ways that you can do that. The first way is putting a meta tag at the top of your page, and a meta tag that says emulate IE7. Now, what happens when you do this is the browser, again, by default, is going to attempt to render your page in IE9 standards mode. So the document will come in, we'll start parsing your page, we'll parse everything that's in the head, and then we'll encounter this tag, and we'll realize this developer really wants this site rendered in our old mode. So we'll reset a bunch of state around the browser, we'll kind of reset that parsing, and then we'll begin reconstructing your page in the legacy mode. So there's a cost to putting this in the meta tag. If you specify that you'd like to render in legacy IE modes, though, via the HTTP header that's returned from that document, we'll know that before we begin parsing the page. So we'll immediately begin to parse in that mode. Kind of the next best practice in terms of just efficiently constructing your markup is to link style sheets at the top of the page. Browsers will download the resources across the page in the order that they're encountered, and when possible, we'll execute them in that order as well. Styles are the most important piece to kind of having a fully rendered page. And so by linking them at the top, they're the first set of resources that are downloaded. It also gives the chance the browser a chance to have them parsed and all the formatting information fully available for when we go to display the page. Never link your style sheets at the bottom of the page. Two of the top 10 news sites in the world link them at the bottom of the page. And I guarantee that just by browsing to those sites, you'll be able to figure out which ones those are. And that's because everything that's above this style information has to be downloaded before the page can be rendered to the screen. All of the images, all the analytics, all the flash advertisements have to be downloaded in that order. So be very cautious of this and avoid it at all costs. Also avoid using the at import for hierarchical styles. If you're familiar with at import, you can specify this inside your CSS. And really, this is the civil equivalent of kind of an include file for CSS itself. When the browser encounters this at import, it's going to explicitly download that style information and inject it at this point in the page. Depending on the patterns that you use in your page, this could cause synchronous blocking in your style construction. Or it could cause your styles to be reconstructed later, causing additional CPU time in the browser itself. So be careful of those. The best practice is really just move them out of those at imports directly into the style sheet itself. And if needed, you can have pre-composed style sheets on the server. Also avoid embedded and inline styles, whether that's a style block or if it's a direct style information on an element itself. The browser, when it encounters this, has to hand that over to that CSS subsystem. And it can be very incremental, and context can be switched back and forth between the browser and the CSS subsystem a lot. And that context has overhead. So by keeping your style information in one single style sheet at the bottom of the page, you can avoid kind of that context switching, or sorry, at the top of the page, you can avoid all that context switching. Only include necessary styles. This is one where people often laugh when I bring talk about this one, because it just feels like common sense. But if you think about a style sheet, oftentimes you'll see kind of a section of styles that are applicable for a div or a particular page. So you might see styles that are for the home page, and in that same style sheet, you might see styles that are applicable for some content page or a subpage. Developers are often a little careless. Or we take shortcuts, and we might use that same style sheet across multiple pages and duplicate styles. This has a few negative consequences in the browser. The first is it's just more bytes to download as you're bringing it down. The second is that CSS is a very inefficient matching algorithm. When you're formatting your document and you're taking all that style information and you're formatting your DOM itself, that can be very CPU intensive. And the more styles you have that have no applicable benefit to that page, it slows down that formatting information itself. And that CPU time that could be used for formatting is actually wasted. Principle number four, optimize the media throughout your website. Media being images and video and audio. If you look at the total number of bytes downloaded across most web pages today, over 75% of those bytes are for media elements. About 25% are markup and script, and the other 75% are media. And the first is really think about your image formats. Now there's a lot of philosophical debates about image formats and quality and purity, and I'm just going to simplify it from a performance perspective. And there's three image formats that I recommend from a best practices perspective. And the first is just PNG. Use PNGs by default for everything. And when needed, you can use JPEGs for higher resolution photographs. And if you're using if you have a really high resolution photograph, a couple of megapixel image that you'd like, you might want to consider one of the new image formats such as JPEG XR. These, from a performance perspective, have the best compression, so it means you're downloading the least number of bytes across the web. But they also have the most efficient decompression algorithms on the CPU itself, which means that you're spending less time on the CPU decoding these images and then passing them down to the GPU than some other formats that are out there. So it impacts your performance in two ways. For your images, make sure that you're using native image resolutions and not sampling down or scaling down your images. Of the new sites that I looked at earlier, two of them on their homepage are scaling down their images. You wouldn't believe how pervasive this is. It's, again, kind of common sense. But if you're scaling it down, there's, again, two problems here. One is more bytes are being transferred over the network. The second is that more CPU time is being required to scale down your image or to compose the constructs to pass down to the GPU for the GPU to scale down your image. And that CPU time, again, impacts page load. Avoid death by 1,000 images, as I like to say. If you go to a website today, it's amazing how many websites have all these little social networking icons along the bottom. You know, tweet me and Facebook me and FooBar me. They're everywhere. And most of these pages link directly to the image from that site. So they'll link directly to the little Twitter icon, which is on a Twitter web service or CDN, or they'll link directly to the Facebook, to the foot one. So you're downloading lots of different images. And in most cases, they're actually specifying the width and the height inline, because they're trying to just inject it into a little location of the page rather than incorporate it. A great solution for that is to use image sprites. If you think about scenario number one, where we have six of these little social networking icons on our page, each of which is 40 pixels wide by 40 pixels tall. If we were to download those images individually, it'd be six different image downloads, six concurrent connections, and about 96K downloaded. If we were to take those six images and kind of incorporate them into one image that was, you know, 240 pixels wide by 40 pixels tall, that's just one image to download. One connection is all that it's going to take to download that image. But it's only 21K because we have much better compression across that entire image. So it really pays you back in multiple dimensions. But if you're going to use image sprites, build them by hand. Don't trust any of the tools that you find on the internet. I have never found a tool on the internet that does a halfway decent job of creating sprites. This is one I created on Sunday. I took some images, just kind of threw those six networking, or those six social networking images. I took two Microsoft logos, I threw them into one of the tools, and I got this. This great big 700 pixel wide by, you know, 300 pixel tall almost image. Now, all of this red area is complete wasted space in the image itself, which impacts performance in a few ways. First is there's a few more bytes that need to be downloaded. Because they're all white, it's actually not too bad in terms of compression size. But it does take longer to decode the image. That decoded image takes more working set when it's on the client and more working set on the GPU itself. So this is very inefficient. The other thing that you'll notice here is that the tool was not intelligent enough to notice that I had two versions of the Microsoft logo that were pixel by pixel equivalent. And so when you're creating these yourself, you can find that duplication quite more easily. Replace images with CSS gradients where possible. We all have these 1 pixel wide by, you know, 500 pixel tall gradients that we use and stretch, and they're quite inefficient to download and very frustrating to kind of create. Whereas with a couple lines of markup, you can now dynamically create this on the client. And by having this markup in your CSS itself, especially kind of that CSS and your CSS is at the top of the page, we'll download that CSS, we'll create the gradient, and we'll have the gradient available much earlier in the process without having to wait for that to be downloaded from the network. The other interesting point about CSS gradients is that creating a CSS gradient takes less CPU time than it takes to decode the image. So there's significant CPU savings as well. When possible, use CSS3 border radius rather than images as well. We all have these 9-grid rounded corner images, or 18-grid if we get really sophisticated with our rounded corners. CSS3 border radius is now pervasive across all modern browsers. It's a great way to get these rounded corner effects on any HTML elements with, again, just a couple lines of markup. And the best part is that with modern hardware accelerated browsers, all of those rounded corners and all of that occurs on the GPU itself, so there's no CPU time impacting your page load. If you have really small images on your page, a good technique is to embed them through the data URI. If you're familiar with the HTML5 data URI, it allows you to specify an image as a 64-bit binary encoded stream, or other data types as well, not just images. In this case, we have an image, and then here's actually the encoded image, which is just the letter, kind of an M icon encoded. So that content can be brought down with the initial page and quickly rendered. For really large images on the page, consider replacing them with SVG, especially inline SVG. With a few lines of markup, you can replace these large, complex images. But be very careful about avoiding SVG complex paths, which, unfortunately, is often what you get when you export from Illustrator. The complex paths are very computationally intensive on both the CPU and the GPU for browsers, and could actually slow down your page. If you're including video in your page, rather than downloading your video or setting it to autoplay or using kind of a preview panel, one great technique that many HTML5 media sites are starting to use is to have an image, a PNG image, which is a preview of the video. Display that preview, and then when the user interacts with the preview, at that time dynamically go and get the video. That saves a lot of bytes coming down from the network. It also allows the browser to focus on loading your page. And where possible, leverage CSS3 transforms. If you're familiar with CSS3 transforms, they're fantastic. They allow you to take any element and to move that element around on the screen, to rotate the element, to skew it. And so these cases where we've had to use, maybe 10, 12 images in the past to create kind of image strips or animations, a great example is kind of those little spinning beach balls to indicate the notification, that something's occurring. Those have to be composed of several images or possibly an image strip. With CSS3 transforms and HTML5-enabled browsers, you can just download that image once, have a little bit of JavaScript that's running in the background to animate that single image to create the same effect. And CSS3 transforms are display only, which means that a full layout is not, no layout activity occurs when a transform is being used. So it only happens entirely on the GPU. A fun technique is to proactively download your next resource. Sites like Bing and Google and some of these others kind of have this, change their logo every single day. Now, if you were to change your logo every single day and then re-download that every day, you lose all the benefits of the caching that we talked about earlier and the number of bytes downloaded. And your users who are coming back to your site every day have to wait a while for that page to appear the first time. If you think about it, such as a site like Bing, if your user has navigated to Bing and they're sitting there and they're typing in a search query, what you could do is you know what image you're going to display the next day, so you can kind of look ahead and in the background initiate a download of that image, even though you're not going to display it in this page. That image will then be brought down, be available in the cache, and then tomorrow when your Bing user comes to the page, that image can be immediately served up without requiring it. So you're kind of just downloading a day ahead. All right, principle 5, write fast JavaScript. A key piece there is really avoid linking JavaScript in the head of your document. We talked about how it's important to include CSS in the head of the document. It's very important to not include JavaScript because when the browser encounters JavaScript, it has to block what it's doing, load that JavaScript, execute it, and then continue parsing the page. That's because the JavaScript might do something like document.write, it might reflect on itself, it might actually change the contents of the page before the browser has fully parsed it. In that same regard, avoid inline JavaScript, whether it's in the head or whether it's in the body. The best practice is really to include a single JavaScript file at the end of the page, or a few JavaScript files at the bottom of your page, and to have those kind of asynchronously attach them to the page contents itself. This will allow the browser to again, parse your full page, download all the style information, download all of your images, and then take care of your JavaScript last. On occasion, you may need to link your JavaScript in the head of the page. You might be trying to incorporate something into a CRM system, or you might be using one of the public blogs or some of the Facebook components, and so you're very limited on where you can inject your JavaScript. So when you're forced to put it in the head, use the defer tag. And the defer tag tells the browser to just continue operating on the page, continue parsing it, But then, you know, go ahead and download this at your convenience and make sure you execute it before the onload event is fired. Remove duplicate code. Another common sense one. But about 50% of the pages on the web have duplicate code in them. This is kind of the extreme example, where you'll link to, you know, two versions of the same JavaScript file, you know, jQuery. But this is a very common example, where a website will link to multiple JavaScript frameworks, all to just get a small little piece of functionality out of that JavaScript framework. Some of the top sites in the world are now including 6 or 7 different JavaScript frameworks in their page loads or in their experience. And there's duplication in functionality. It may not be duplication in code, but it's really duplication in functionality. You might have 10 functions in your page that all traverse the DOM or build abstraction layers. And so really standardize on a single framework. I don't have a preference. I think they're all, many of them are great frameworks that are out there. But find one and standardize on it. Also, don't include script to be cool. Really minimize the amount of script in your page that's not executed, because all of the script that is brought down has to be parsed by the browser. In many cases, it has to be kind of compiled. It impacts the size of the type system. A common pattern is, you know, we're starting to see emerge on the web, is sites will include all the little Facebook buttons or the little Facebook controls. I was looking at a site last week that probably had 4 or 5 different analytics engines running at once inside the site. All of those take time. In fact, in the case of that site, about 70% of the CPU time loading the site was spent in doing analytics across all these engines, not in the browser actually loading the site or the developer's code running. So be careful. And really know what the script that you include on your page is doing. You might be surprised how much work is occurring and how much data is being sent places. Minify your JavaScript. And there's a couple of techniques around minification that are important. The first is character removal, decreasing the number of bytes from your page. If you look at the function at the top, you'll see that there's some characters in here that are semantically not important to our code. And the first is, you'll see there's a tab that indents the return statement. Now, that tab, depending on your editor, could actually be 5 characters. And those 5 characters are 5 different bytes, which all have to be downloaded. So you can easily remove unnecessary brackets and spaces from your script. In this case, we've decreased our script from 66 characters down to 54. The second technique around JavaScript minification is called compaction. And compaction will change the variable names and other constructs in your code. So in this case, we have number 1, and it decreased it down to a single character letter, such as A. By compacting this entire statement, we've decreased it from 54 characters down to 30. Now, there's a couple of benefits here. Again, just less bytes being transferred over the network. It's also less bytes in the cache, so it's more likely that your file is going to reside in the cache for a longer period of time. Another huge benefit, though, is that inside JavaScript, the type system resolution, looking up a variable name, can be one of the most expensive pieces to script execution. And the smaller your variable names, the quicker that's going to be. Now, that's a super micro-optimization, but you get that micro-optimization across your entire application just through minification. The last technique around minification, which can be a little dangerous depending on your application, you have to be cautious when you're doing this, but is enabling some type of inlining. And there's a few tools that do inlining today. But if we go back to kind of our function sum, which is the function that we were just looking at, this is the minified version of it. Now, if our function sum is only called from one function, getScore, in our application, and getScore just takes the score from the first half of the ball game and the second half of the ball game and sums them together to get the total score for the ball game. If it's only called from that one function, it doesn't really need to be a separate function in that instance of the page. And so that entire code can be inlined into a single statement. Now, in this case, we've decreased, through these 3 JavaScript techniques, we've decreased our page load, or this JavaScript, from 150 characters down to 37. So we've shaved off about 75% of it. Less bytes, better cacheability, faster type system resolution, all from minification. When you go to initiate your JavaScript, there's a couple places where you could initialize it today. The most common is load, the load event. In fact, the majority of the script on the web today triggers off the onload event. The DOM content loaded event, though, has emerged over the past couple of years. And the DOM content loaded event can fire significantly earlier than the load event, especially for users that are on slow networks and lower-end devices, such as mobile devices. And so by initializing your JavaScript off the load event, you can have two huge benefits. One is you can actually start your JavaScript executing 2 to 3 times earlier, depending on the scenario, than the load event. So very, very, very early. The second is that you can actually decrease the CPU time, because if there's a very long period between DOM content loaded and the load event, the browser might do multiple layouts or multiple iterations. So the sooner you can manipulate the DOM, the faster your page is going to load, the less CPU time. A great technique there is also initializing JavaScript on demand. And this is kind of a technique. There's a few different techniques you could use here. The one I have snippet for here is you essentially have kind of stub functions in your page that come down with your page for the features that aren't very commonly used. In this case, it might be changing your user tile. If you know a user only changes their user tile once every 3 months or 4 months, you don't need to download and have that code available every single time. So you can just go ahead and download it on demand when they actually go to change their user tile. JSON is always faster than XML for data. It's just a very simple rule. In fact, it can be 15 to 20 times faster depending on your scenario. There's a few reasons for this. The XML is much more verbose. The XML has to go through a preprocessor before it can be serialized. There's a few buffers that come into play. But JSON is the way to go from a performance perspective. And when you're using JSON, always use the internal browser methods for JSON, for parsing and stringifying your JSON methods. They can be 100 to 200 times faster than the script-based methods that you might be familiar with today. These methods were added inside Internet Explorer 8 and are common today. Use regular expressions very sparingly. If you think back to Computer Science 101, I know there's a lot, I think we're mostly computer scientists in the room. You remember regular expressions build really complex trees and take a lot of memory. The more regular expressions you have in your page load, the slower your page load is going to be. I have never seen a scenario where using a regular expression is actually faster than writing a couple lines of procedural code to parse something. They're cool, they're fun, they're really convenient, but they're not fast. A rule of thumb I use that I often recommend is never include a regular expression in your page load. It will only slow you down. And after your page is loaded, never include more than one or two regular expressions in any user interaction. JavaScript, kind of the data type inside JavaScript, is a double precision float. So if you think about an example where we take a var test and we divide 25 divided by 2, the number that's actually represented in memory is not 12.5. It's this big hex number with a mantissa and exponents and kind of a bunch of geeky terms. The side effect of that is it's this really big long number that's not actually 12.5. It's 12.499999. Browsers, especially browsers that support subpixel rendering, will take these values and will actually apply them. So if you're animating a little character off this along the screen, and you say to move to location 12.5, you're actually moving to location 12.4999 all the way down, and the browser will move it to that location. That's much more expensive than integer math, or than moving to a straight location. So you can always get your numbers back to integers using seal and floor. So if we were to seal this, of course, we would go to 13. If we would floor it, we would go to 12. But we then have integers again. So the JavaScript engine, when it goes to do computation, it can do integers directly in registers and much more efficiently. The browser just has to move it to a fixed location very, very efficiently. This is not an optimization you probably want to apply across your code in general, but in tight loops where you're doing math, especially division, then you will always get a performance benefit by using math.seal and math.floor. You might be familiar with the Facebook JavaScript game benchmark that they've been building over the past few months. By using seal and floor in the right locations in their application, they were essentially able to double the performance of their framework and the number of frames per second just by decreasing the computation. Minimize your DOM interactions. If you think about this line of code right here, this is actually 3 DOM interactions. What's happening here is that your script is saying, hey, browser, go get me the current document, and then the document's returned. And then you're saying, hey, browser, here's my document, go get me the body. And then you're saying it again with all. And so you're constantly going back and forth between the DOM itself. So there's a few best practices here. Really minimize the number of DOM interactions. Only pass that, go across that boundary when you need to. But also cache your variables locally. In the case here where you see var L side equals this, we've now crossed it 3 times, but we now have a reference to it to our left side, our L side. And so we can now get back to this just by going L side dot. This couple lines of script actually has 9 DOM interactions. It could be consolidated to 3. Use the built-in DOM methods, or I should say the built-in DOM methods are always more efficient than rolling your own behaviors. In this case, we have a node, and we go and get the first element of the node. By calling the built-in DOM methods to go get the next sibling or the previous sibling of that node, it's almost instantaneous. In fact, it's almost 100 times faster than trying to do this yourself in script. So let the browser take care of these computationally intensive things for you. You can use the selectors API to return very large data sets from the browser itself. In this case, we're going using query selector all. We're returning all the required elements from our page, and then we can iterate over them. Inner HTML is always faster than is the fastest mechanism to construct your page. In this case, you know, we're calling inner HTML to inject a username. Inner HTML can be 50 to 100 times faster than attempting to construct a single node, a node yourself, depending on your patterns. This one is extremely important. If there's a couple that you walk away from today, this is one of them. And that is to batch all of your markup changes. In this case, we're building up a page, and we'll build the title, and then we'll build the body of the page, and then we'll build the footer on the page itself. When we build each of these in JavaScript, we could then call inner HTML 3 times and inject them into the page 3 times. Or we could just concatenate them together into a single string in the JavaScript engine and then call inner HTML on that single string. This can be hundreds of times faster than any other mechanism. Maintain a small and healthy DOM. This one is extremely important as well. The larger that your DOM grows, the slower it is for any interaction on that DOM to occur. The slower it is to traverse, the slower it is to manipulate. It also starts to put memory pressure on the DOM itself. I was looking at a page a few months ago that had 120,000 elements in the DOM itself. And essentially what this web developer had done is every single UI element that they could ever have in their page, you know, the save dialog and the find dialog, they were all like hidden divs in the page. You know, I think they only ever opened one file in their text editor for their entire web app. And that pressure puts a lot of pressure on the browser itself. Now, the rule I like to recommend is think 1,000 elements. Think about how you can construct your page with under 1,000 DOM elements. If you can do that, your page is most likely to be fast across not just desktop devices, but across all the mobile devices and the lower-end machines of tomorrow. Okay, the last principle. Principle number 6 is know what your applications are doing when they're running. You'd be surprised how many people have no clue. They've loaded their page and they think it's doing something, and they're waiting for that click to occur. But you really have to understand what your page is doing. There's kind of two primary ways which your page will start to do something. The first is the user interacts with it. They move their mouse around, they click, they type a key. The second is through timers, using set timeout or set interval. Set interval is great for animations and really kind of long-running interactions on the page. And of course, you know, set or interval will just keep calling you back every n milliseconds based on what you specified in your application. 25% of the web pages in the world today, 25% of the top 100,000 web pages in the world today have a runaway timer, where it's escaped from the developer and it's going and running in the background and doing something and taking a bunch of CPU, and the developer doesn't know that it's there. So the best practice is to minimize your timers and align your timers and really make sure that you don't have any runaway timers. In this case, this application has three running timers, one that's calling back every 6 milliseconds, one that's calling back every 10 milliseconds, and one that's calling back every 50 milliseconds. We could align these. We could go through and say, you know, that's 6 milliseconds. I really don't need to be calling that every 6 milliseconds. I could call it every 10, and I just align them down to that same callback and that same function. I could look at maybe my 10s and think to myself, you know, I really don't need to be calling this 5 times every 10 milliseconds. I could just align that to my 50 millisecond timer. Now, the second, probably most important for those HTML5 application scenarios I talked about, the second most important best practice to walk away with is to align your animations to the display frame. This is a tricky one, that most LCDs in the world are running at 60 hertz, which means 60 frames a second. That means this glass can update the screen 60 times every second. If you're doing a set timeout of 10 or set interval of 10, and you're animating or moving things around the screen, that means your code is actually running 100 times a second, and it's moving those characters around 100 times a second. But it can only ever get to the glass 60 times a second. So your user can't even see half of that activity. But that activity is taking CPU time, it's taking machine resources, and it's impacting your web page perf. So for all animations, you should align them to an interval of 16.77 milliseconds. And in fact, if you're targeting mobile or lower-end devices, you might want to consider aligning them to an interval of 13.4 milliseconds or 30 frames a second. The best practice and kind of my advice is I've never seen an application that needs called back more than 16.7 milliseconds. So if you have timers in your application that are really low numbers, zeros, ones, tens, twelves, you're wasting a lot of CPU time and negatively impacting perf. So those were the 57 best practices I wanted to cover today. I have 2 minutes and 12 seconds, 2 minutes and 12 seconds left, so we are right on time. Going back over the six principles. So first principle, quickly respond to network requests. Get that data back to the client as quickly as you can. Minimize the number of bytes that are downloaded. Efficiently structure your markup. Optimize your media, write fast JavaScript, and then know what your application is doing. Since we're short on time, I'm not going to be able to take any questions. I will take questions up on the stage, or we can go out into the hallway. Happy to take questions for a while, but I won't be able to take them in the large group forum. But there are a lot of great resources on performance that are out there today. There's an O'Reilly series on performance. The Internet Explorer blog is a great place to get started. We walk through how to use the same tools that I use to measure performance across these sites inside your applications today. And I have a link to those tools down here as well. You can take a look at the IE test drive and and all of the demos that we have. Many of our demos follow these best practices, and the way we're able to achieve 60 frames a second here is through the patterns that I talked about today. In the 13 seconds that I have left, I'm just going to go ahead and view source and show you this really quickly. You'll see that we're using the HTML5 document tag. We are specifying a meta tag, but it's the IE10 meta tag. We link our style sheets at the top of the page. We link, the most important resource in this that takes the longest to download is actually that video in the background. It's about 900K. So that is the first resource that we start to download on one of our concurrent connections. All of our JavaScript is linked at the bottom of the page as well. So you can take a look at our demos. You can see how we're able to get this level of performance in not just the Internet Explorer, but across all the browsers that are becoming hardware accelerated, and apply these to your sites today. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone for attending today. I will be taking, again, questions here on the side. Please submit speaker evaluations so that we can be invited back again next year, and thank you.